Tonight's reading is taken from John, chapter 8, verses 31 to 59, which can be found on page 1078 of the Church Bibles. So that's page 1078, and it's John, chapter 8, verses 31 to 59. So Jesus said to the Jews who had believed in him, "If you abide in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." They answered him, "We are offspring of Abraham and have never been enslaved to anyone. How is it that you say you will become free?" Jesus answered them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, everyone who commits sin is a slave to sin. The slave does not remain in the house forever. The son remains forever. So if the son sets you free, you will be free indeed. I know that you are offspring of Abraham, yet you seek to kill me, because my word finds no place in you. I speak of what I have seen with my father, and you do what you have heard from your father." They answered him, "Abraham is our father." Jesus said to them, "If you were Abraham's children, you would be doing the works Abraham did. But now you seek to kill me, a man who has told you the truth that I heard from God. This is not what Abraham did. You are doing the works your father did." They said to him, "We were not born of sexual immorality. We have one father, even God." Jesus said to them, "If God were your father, you would love me, for I came from God, and I am here. I came not of my own accord, but he sent me. Why do you not understand what I say? It is because you cannot bear to hear my word. You are of your father, the devil, and your will is to do your father's desires. He was a murderer from the beginning, and has nothing to do with the truth, because there is no truth in him. When he lies, he speaks out of his own character, for he is a liar and the father of lies. But because I tell the truth, you do not believe me. Which one of you convicts me of sin? If I tell the truth, why do you not believe me? Whoever is of God hears the words of God. The reason why you do not hear them is that you are not of God." The Jews answered him, "Are we not right in saying that you are a Samaritan and have a demon?" Jesus answered, "I do not have a demon, but I honor my Father, and you dishonor me. Yet I do not seek my own glory. There is one who seeks it, and he is the judge. Truly, truly, I say to you, if anyone keeps my word, he will never see death." The Jews said to him, "Now we know that you have a demon. Abraham died, as did the prophets, yet you say, 'If anyone keeps my word, he will never taste death.' Are you greater than our father Abraham, who died, and the prophets died? Who do you make yourself out to be?" Jesus answered, "If I glorify myself, my glory is nothing. It is my Father who glorifies me, of whom you say, 'He is our God.' But you have not known him. I know him. If I were to say that I do not know him, I would be a liar like you. But I do know him, and I keep his word. Your father, Abraham, rejoiced that he would see my day. He saw it and was glad." So the Jews said to him, "You are not yet 50 years old, and have you seen Abraham?" Jesus said to them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was, I am." So they picked up stones to throw at him, but Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple.
Well, Jesse, thank you very much indeed for reading for us. May I add my welcome to you. I suspect there are a number of people visiting us this evening, as there have been through the day. And if that's you, you're particularly welcome amongst us, especially if you're with us from a Muslim background. There have been one or two people with us earlier from that background, and we're delighted you've been able to join us this evening to look at this very important issue. An unusual series, because normally we take books of the Bible and work straight through them. But we've called the series Light and Lies. We're looking at specific issues that are of particular relevance to our culture. The Bible always helps us to understand the world in which we live. God's word makes sense of God's world. Last week, gender and sexuality. How free are we really? And this evening, our subject is Islam and the question, what would Jesus say to Muhammad? Now, as we begin, let me say that I'm well aware we find ourselves addressing this subject at a time of particular uncertainty and confusion, and in some cases in our culture, I think, real fear. The secularists of the late 20th century genuinely believed that with the advance of modernism, all religion would inevitably die out. And we have to say they've received, at the start of the 21st century, a fairly rude awakening. The rise of Islam and the continued advance of Christianity, coupled with the ethical and demographic implosion of Western society, has meant that our world today in Britain is more religious than ever, and actually religion becomes more attractive as our culture implodes ethically and demographically. You may have come across, I think I mentioned before, the editor of the Economist's book, God is Back, rather a cheeky title, as if God ever went away, but demonstrating that our world is more religious at the start of the 21st century than it ever was. And admission in there by some of the chief secularist thinkers of the late 20th century that they got it wrong. However, that means that our secularist rulers are left largely ignorant of the world views of many of the people who they are supposed to be governing. Ignorant of the true teaching of Jesus because of the failure of the late 20th century church to present the teaching of Jesus, and ignorant of Islam through lack of exposure, and therefore still believing what is an illogical and pretty dangerous lie that all religions are essentially the same, and trying to paper over the cracks between the religions and to legislate from their state of ignorance. At the same time, to the outside observer, I think it's fair to say that there's a real battle going on within Islam. I'm not an expert in this, some of you are, but there are on the one hand the liberals who are seeking to reinterpret the Quran in order to make its teaching morally acceptable and socially acceptable to the norms of the Western society. You may have come across the Exploring Islam Foundation, a liberal Islamic group deliberately aiming to enable Western men like you and me to explore the Islamic faith in an acceptable way. And the kind of article that came last week in one of the weekend magazines, I think, is more and more common. Meet the New Converts, and a whole series of a testimony given by young Western women who have converted to Islam. So on the one hand, we have the liberal end of Islam looking to make conversion more attractive and finding a real hearing in a culture that is sort of at the end of its, possibly at the end of its dominance in the West. But then on the other hand, we have to say that there is still the extremist wing of Islam all around us, looking to draw true Muslims to the true teaching of the Quran and to enforce Islam on the cultures in which it finds itself. Yesterday, one of the broadsheets had a rather loud headline, MI5 warns of the Al-Qaeda preacher targeting Britain. Allow me to make clear what my aim is not this evening. So my aim is categorically not to stir up fear, hatred, mistrust, division, and unrest. You know, one comes across a public perception of, in inverted commas, Muslims, presented by the very noisy tabloid press that, all Muslims are, dot, 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 dot. And let me say, that sort of playground name-calling is absolutely not on the agenda of St. Helens, and I hope it never will be. And I hope that Muslim friends, colleagues, will feel very, relatives, will be very welcome to come and explore Christian things here and find themselves made welcome. I want rather to go back to the teaching of Jesus, to put it alongside the teaching of Muhammad, and to explore together what we think Jesus would have said to Muhammad. Now, let me just say that I know not all Muslims would necessarily say or believe the same things as Muhammad. I haven't got my head in the sand. I know there's a degree of nuance within the various Islamic movements and so on. However, I do think it's fair to take the teaching of the Quran and to take the teaching of the Bible and say, okay, given the teaching of both, what would Jesus have had to say to the Prophet Muhammad? Ah, you say, ha-ha, and I can just hear you saying it, but Muhammad received his revelation starting in 610 AD. Jesus walked the earth in the early first century. So how can you possibly say what they were going to say to each other? Well, there is a place in the New Testament, I think probably the clearest of all, where Jesus addresses a group of people who believe themselves to be children of Abraham and who recognize Jesus to be somebody special. And even if you have the most basic understanding of the Quran, you will know that a true Muslim will recognize Jesus to be somebody special and will consider himself or herself to be a child of Abraham. Listen to Surah 2:87. To Moses we gave the scriptures, and after him we sent other apostles. We gave Jesus, son of Mary, veritable signs and strengthened him with the Holy Spirit. And then Surah 2:136. We believe in God and that which has been revealed to us. In what was revealed to Abraham, Ishmael, Isaac, Jacob and the tribes, to Moses and Jesus and the other prophets by their Lord. And then listen to a further reference. There are, I think, over 50 references I've totted up so far to Jesus in the Quran, all of them positive. We gave Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, Job, Joseph, Moses, Aaron, Zacharias, John, Jesus and Elias. All were upright men. So we can't deny that the Quran has a very high view of Jesus, and all Muslims should do if they're true Muslims. And we can't deny that the Muslim who follows the teaching of the Quran will consider themselves to be a child of Abraham. Yes, through the line of Ishmael rather than through the line of Isaac, but nonetheless, if you meet a Muslim friend, they will consider themselves to be a child of Abraham and therefore a true child of God. Now, there is a point in the Gospels where Jesus comes face to face with a group of people who hold themselves to be children of Abraham and also hold him to be very special. And that's the passage which we must rightly go to if we're going to understand Jesus' view on such a person. And I want to ask you the question. I'm not going to spoon feed you. I greatly believe in the congregation doing at least as much work as the preacher, so I hope you haven't come for a rest. I'm going to ask you to answer the question, what then would Jesus have to say to the prophet Muhammad? John 8:31-32. If you're not there, you need to be. Page 1078. So Jesus said to the Jews who had believed in him, if you abide in my words, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. In other words, you might say, Jesus would take Muhammad at his word. He would take seriously Muhammad's claim, and the claim that's written there in the Quran, and he would then turn to Muhammad and say, okay, so you really do recognize me as a prophet. That's what you say you recognize me as. If you do, then you will treat me as a prophet and you'll seek to take me seriously and accept my words, and then you will be truly free. Now, you can't have failed to notice that that demand by Jesus stirs up in his listeners an objection, which I would suggest, is precisely the objection that would be raised by Muhammad and the followers of the Islamic religion. The objection is there in verse 33, and it comes in two parts, one to do with spiritual identity and the other to do with moral liberty. So glance at verse 33. They answered him, "But we're offspring of Abraham." That's the spiritual identity. "And we've never been enslaved to anyone." There's the moral liberty. "How is it that you say you will become free?" And Jesus tackles the second objection first as he turns to consider the issue of our moral liberty. And you'll find that part of the answer in verse 34 to 38, the moral liberty of men and women like you and me. And the question he wants to ask us is this: are you really free? Now, the heart of the answer comes in verse 34 and 35. And the key to getting hold of what Jesus is saying lies in the second reference to sin at the end of verse 34. So let me read it, and then we'll come to that second reference to sin. Jesus answered them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, everybody who commits sin is a slave to sin. The slave does not remain in the house forever. The son remains forever. So if the son sets you free, you'll be free indeed." Now, the word sin there is both a noun, not a verb, and in the singular, not in the plural. So literally translated, verse 34 would read like this: all the doing the sin, slaves are to the sin. And Jesus' point is this: look, the very fact that you sin and that you can't stop sinning is a demonstration of the fact that you and I are actually not free at all. We are captives in the realm or sphere of the sin. We're not, as we like to think of ourselves, free beings walking liberated and enlightened through the world. Quite the reverse. We are captives, enslaved in the realm of sin and death. Now, this, of course, runs completely culture. Forget about the Muslim. Would you like to go and lock the door for us so that we don't have any sightseers wandering in and distracting everybody? It's far too important to muddle up with sightseeing. This idea that we are actually enslaved to sin and judgment, death, and separation from God runs completely counter to the whole of our 21st century culture. Forget the Islamic religion for a moment. It just runs against everything that you've been taught since your mother's cradle, unless you've been brought up as a Christian. We like to kid ourselves that we are free agents, able to travel and explore and experience and choose. But Jesus is suggesting that that is a dreamlike fantasy, that we're not free, we're not morally free. We find ourselves saying and doing things that we wish we didn't, and we find ourselves rejecting the rule of God and enslaved to it. And not only are we morally bound, we are not free spiritually. And if only we had time, I'd want to show that we're not free geographically, economically, socially, temporally. We are bound. Please note, Jesus is not saying that you're as bad as you could be. So he is not suggesting that all of us pick up rifles and go on killing sprees, or that all of us take up crossbows and murder unprotected women, or that all of us strap explosives to our waists in order to blow up and detonate family weddings. What he is saying is that you and I are held captive in the realm of sin, resulting in God's judgment, death, and separation from God forever. The sin. Sin, you see, is rebellion against God. And sin, as we saw last week, is epitomized by Adam and Eve saying to God, "Well, actually, I'm going to do it my way," and shaking the fist at their creator and thinking that they're going to be enlightened in so doing. That's sin. I didn't have the a good fortune to join Neil Fullard in Britain Got Talent and sing along with him when he did his Frank Sinatra impersonation. But, you know, those of us, which I suspect is probably most of us, who have stood in the shower and sung, "I did it my way," that is the epitome of sin. It's rebellion against God. Not your way, mine. And now, says Jesus, the very fact that you fail to keep the perfect law of God, the very fact that you can't keep it, you don't even want to keep it, demonstrates that you are enslaved. Oh, some of us will do it in open hostility. You know, the Richard Dawkins, the Christopher Hitchens, the Philip Pullman, the Jonathan Ross, a sort of open defiance against God. I see a sign saying, "Don't walk on the grass." How dare they put it there? And I put on my walking boots and stride across it down at Guy's Hospital or whatever it happens to be. Others of us do it in a much more kind of behind-the-neck-curtain, suburban English kind of way. But in my heart of hearts, I will not submit to God's rule. And the very fact that I do things and think things and say things that I know God hates is demonstration of a deep attitude, albeit covered with religious or middle-class veneer of rebellion. And of course, once having rebelled against God, our acts of rebellion have to be judged. God cannot allow imperfection and impurity to go undealt with. He can't just sweep it under the carpet. He's just. And here then is Jesus, who says, look, anyone who sins is a slave to the sin. But if you hear my teaching, if you come to me, I who have come to offer forgiveness, to pay God's judgment at your sin, to die on a cross for you, to carry God's just anger at your sin, I can set you free from it. Now let me stress again, this argument could be deployed towards absolutely anybody, and regardless of the Islamic religion that we're considering this evening. You know, our culture claims to be free. It's one of the great absolutes of our age. Challenge it if you dare. But Jesus would say, you're not morally free, you can't do what you want. You're not socially free, you can't meet and mix with who you want. You're not economically free, you can't have what you want. You're not temporally free, you can't live as long as you want. And you're certainly not geographically free, you can't go where you want. As one Australian friend said to me at some stage, what kind of idiot believes in the freedom of the will? It's rather nicely put, I thought. Well, Jesus says, come to me, surrender to my teaching, receive the forgiveness that I offer you, and you will be free indeed, free from the sin, God's judgment. Now, of course, that could be applied to absolutely anybody, but it's not hard to see how Jesus' teaching applies to the Jews here in John 8 or to Muslims who consider themselves to be children of Abraham. The teaching of the Quran holds that you and I are not morally enslaved. In Islam, sin is not a state or a condition but an act which can be avoided. And in Islam, all people can be allowed to enter paradise as long as they believe in one Allah and Muhammad, his apostle, and do their best to avoid major sins. So there's no such concept, such a thing as the sin, as we find here in Islam. But Jesus will want to say to Muhammad, do you not actually find yourself to be enslaved? I mean, let's take the teaching of Moses, whom you hold up as a great prophet, who, in summary, said you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your mind, all your soul, all your strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. Do you really love the Lord as you know you ought? And what will the perfect justice of God have to do with you for all that you failed? Even your own five pillars. I mean, I know you haven't kept them. The recital of the confession, the pilgrimage to Mecca, the prayers five times a day, the almsgiving, the Ramadan festival. I mean, you know there have been breaches. And from within, you know, what actually comes up from within, as Jesus said, from within, out of the heart of men, come all these evil things, evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, coveting, wickedness, deceit, sensuality, envy, slander, pride, folly. What actually does come out of your heart? What wells up? You know that all these evil things that you hate come from within. You're not really free. And so says Jesus, the one who you, Muslim, hold so highly, if you really do come to me and abide in my words, you will know the truth. For with me you will find a way of full and free forgiveness that preserves the justice of God as I carry God's judgment on your behalf and extends to you the offer of the mercy and love of God. Here then is the first line of approach that Jesus would take with Muhammad. And I would suggest that it's a useful line of approach to take with anyone, but certainly with any of my Muslim friends, to talk about the issue of sin and what's going to happen to your sin. And do you have any means of forgiveness of your sin other than just paying it off in hell? That line of approach stirs up a second area of discussion, which moves from moral liberty to spiritual identity, and you will find that in verse 39 through to 47. The issue begins to be addressed by Jesus in verse 37, and it really comes under the spotlight in verse 39. Let me read the verses so that we're familiar with them. I know that you're offspring of Abraham, verse 37, yet you seek to kill me because my words find no place in you. I speak of what I've seen with my father, and you do what you've heard from your father. They answered him, Abraham is our father. Jesus said to them, if you were Abraham's children, you would be doing what Abraham did, but now you seek to kill me, a man who's told you the truth that I heard from God. This is not what Abraham did. You are doing what your father did. They said to him, we're not born of sexual immorality. We have one father, even God. Jesus said to them, if God were your father, you would love me, for I came from God and I am here. I came not of my own accord, but he sent me. Why do you not understand what I say? It is because you cannot bear to hear my word. You are of your father the devil, and your will is to do your father's desires. He was a murderer from the beginning and has nothing to do with the truth because there is no truth in him. When he lies, he speaks out of his own character, for he is a liar and the father of lies. But because I tell the truth, you do not believe me. Which one of you convicts me of sin? If I tell the truth, why do you not believe me? Whoever is of God hears the words of God. The reason you don't hear them is that you are not of God. So now the second area that Jesus explores with his listeners has to do with our spiritual identity. And the logic is really very simple. Are you, you who claim to be a child of Abraham, are you really genuinely part of his family? I know you say you're genetically related, granted, but are you really a child of his? Before we get into the logic of this, just a couple of points about Islam. Any Muslim will tell you that they are connected to Abraham. It's an Abrahamic religion, as people like to call it. Muslim historians believe that Muhammad was the descendant of Abraham through the line of Abraham's son, Ishmael. They also believe that Abraham and his son together built the Kaaba at Mecca, and they prayed to God to send a prophet to Mecca, and the answer to the prayers was the sending of Muhammad. You can find that in Surah 2, 1-5, Surah 3, 6-7, and Surah 5, 13-19. What then does Jesus have to say to a person who claims to be a true child of Abraham? Well, his response is very straightforward and logical. Simply having blood relations and carrying DNA doesn't mean that you stand for everything they stand for or stand to inherit everything promised to them. I mean, just because, let's take as an example, given they're not here this evening, one of my children is genetically related to me, doesn't necessarily mean that they are a true standing for everything that I stand for and due to inherit everything that I might offer to them. I might easily cut them off. Don't tell them that. I'm not planning it. So Jesus says, look, I know that you carry Abraham's genes in your body, but the proof of the pudding as to whether you're a true child of Abraham spiritually lies in whether you love the things Abraham loved and believe the things Abraham believed. If you do, then you're part of his family spiritually, and if you do not, then you must be from a different family, and there are only two to choose from. Now, once again, this line of argument could be used towards absolutely anybody. So we're not singling out just one race or one ethnic group, one culture, one... You know, you could say this to your Western secularist friend. Oh, you claim to recognize Jesus as a spokesman from God. You say that, but you won't actually sit under, accept, follow, walk with him. The fact that you claim to recognize him, but you won't walk with him, shows that you're not part of his family. And there are only two families to choose from. The substance is there in verse 42 and 47, which bracket the section, isn't it? Where Jesus says, if God were your father, you would love me, for I came from God and I am here. And 47, whoever is of God hears the words of God. The reason you don't hear them is that you're not of God. So to our Muslim friend, Jesus will say, look, you hold me to be a prophet on a par with Abraham, Isaac, Moses, Elijah, and John the Baptist. That's what your Quran says. If I am a prophet who came from God, as your Quran says, you must accept the truth that I teach. If you refuse to accept the truth that I teach, well, either the Quran is a lie and I am not a prophet from God, or alternatively, you're not part of God's family at all. And there are only two options. A childish illustration. Imagine for one awful moment that you found yourself to be Australian. I'm sorry if you're here as an Australian, there were one or two Australians. There's one just sitting in the front row. Let's change track. Imagine to your delight you discovered that you were Australian and you were part of the true race. And you, aged 50-something, wanted to send a message to us here, and you have a... It's so important you want to send it personally through, and so you choose your son. I will send my son, what should we call him, Bruce or Dazza? I don't know, whatever. Dazza, maybe, I don't know what we'll call him. We'll call him Bruce, and you say, I'll send my son, and you write to us months ahead, I'm going to send him such and such on the airplane, and assuming British Airways aren't on strike, etc., etc. And then a couple of weeks before, fax it through, details, please meet him, then text, and so on and so forth. And Bruce turns up at the airport, and there's no one there to meet him. Funny. He comes to the office here at St. Helens at midweek. Sorry, we're not interested. We know where you come from. We don't want you. He tries to get into the 6 o'clock service, and the welcomers on the door. The welcomers on the door see him. They've been given a picture of him. They see him. I'm sorry, Bruce, you are not welcome. What does that tell you back in Australia about our attitude to you? Clearly, we hate you. We want nothing to do with you. We're not interested in your family. We're from another family altogether. So then I think we would want to explore it along these lines. And isn't Jesus' teaching ruthlessly logical? Inescapably logical? Look, my friend, you know you claim to be a child of Abraham, and so does Muhammad. You and your prophet recognize Jesus as a prophet from God on the line with all these other people. You tell us we've got to take his teaching seriously. If you really are a spiritual child of Abraham, then you'll accept what he has to say. If not, then we've got to call into question your spiritual identity. You may be able to trace your links genetically, but spiritually, if you choose to reject Jesus, it shows that you're from a completely different family from that of God, and there are only two to choose from. Now, I think I'm going to leave it there, and we'll come to questions in a minute. It's time to draw things to a conclusion. I think I want to set you the question. I want you to take this passage across to after eights when we go across to eat supper together. I want you to look at it, particularly verse 31 through to verse 59, and I want you to ask the question, what do you think Jesus would say to Muhammad? Actually, what happens, this leads the discussion on to a completely different level, because his listeners then start to question Jesus' identity. He's called into question their identity. They now have called into question his identity. Look at verse 48. Are we not right in saying that you are a Samaritan and have a demon? And the discussion in 48 to 59 now moves from who the father of those who claim themselves to have Abraham as their father is to who the true father of Jesus is. Look at verse 58. Jesus said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was, I am. So they picked up stones to throw at him, but Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple. The name I am is God's name in the Bible. It's the name that God reveals himself to Moses through. I am who I am, Yahweh. And Jesus stands up and says, before Abraham was, I am. And they know that it's straight blasphemy. He is claiming to be God. And so they pick up stones to stone him. Well, what have we got to say? As with last week, three short areas of application. To the non-Christian secularist world, on my bookshelf at home, I have a number of books written at the end of the 20th century telling us that God is dead. Ludwig Kennedy, that well-known atheist, All in the Mind. A.N. Wilson, God's Funeral. 9/11 and 7/7 provided a rude awakening for the modernist. And you'll find Micklethwaite and Wooldridge fascinating in their analysis of things. They quote from one writer, when historians look back at this century, the 21st, they will probably see religion as the prime animating force in human affairs, guiding attitudes to political liberty and obligations. So a wake-up call to the secularist. To the liberal Western church, where the prevailing orthodoxy in the liberal church is that all religions are basically man-made, different paths up the same mountain, which is what I was brought up in when I went to theological college in the 1980s, following the teaching of people like John Hick and Cupid, I've forgotten his first name now, but then Michael, you'll know. Don Cupid, that's right. And not because you're an adherent of his, obviously, Michael, but there we go. But that was their basic teaching. Just a very brief look at 30 verses of the New Testament has shown that to be self-evident nonsense. You cannot say that Jesus, who tells, this is a religious discussion, isn't it? You cannot say that Jesus, who tells his Jewish listeners who claim that they are children of Abraham, but won't, and then tells them they're not from God's family, they're from the other side completely. You cannot say that then Jesus and the Jews are basically heading the same way up the same, different ways up the same mountain. It's self-evident nonsense. And so to the Western church, it does immense damage in our culture as it seeks to persuade the muddled secularists that actually we're all basically saying the same thing. Quite self-evidently, we're not. And the Western church will lead our culture into even greater morass for us at St. Helens. We are not joining the English Defence League. Okay, they're marching through Tower Hamlets next week, I believe, in order to sort of protest for the English way of life. That's not what we're about here. We are not here just trying to defend Englishness against the Islamic invasion. We're not into tabloid, playground, shrill comments like that. We love our Muslim friends and neighbours. And I suspect there may well come a day when churches in England actually offer sanctuary to Muslims. And I hope we will be amongst those who do it if the need, God forbid, ever happens. So we are not into stirring up hatred. We love
our Muslim friends and colleagues. But let's be clear. Where somebody claims to be a child of Abraham and hold Jesus highly as they do, Jesus says, you're enslaved just like everybody else and you need to be freed from your sin. I can do it. That's why I came. And if you reject my teaching, you claim that I'm a prophet. And by rejecting me, either you're suggesting the Quran is a lie, or you're showing that you are not part of God's family at all. Well, we're going to pause there and a chance for questions. Charlie, over to you.
Why don't you stand next to each other? And I'll just go with the first question. No, I won't. I may have to get my phone consultant.
You're just checking your text, aren't you? You're on Facebook.
Not deliberately.
Do you want me to take one from the floor?
Yeah, Dave, can you just...
Anyone want to ask a question from the floor? That's how we did it earlier. Is anybody interested to sing out a question? Don't be shy. Go ahead. Yes, thank you. Thank you. Our Muslim friends would almost certainly come back and say, well, hang on, this, the scriptures, is not an historical source, and they would want to address issues of criticism of the historical material of the Bible, and that's precisely where I'd be ready to go. And, there was a conference here yesterday, actually, defending the authenticity of the New Testament as accurate records of the life and teaching of Jesus. And I'd want to spend a lot of time with them exploring their questions over the authentic eyewitness. They claim to be eyewitness documents. They actually are written like eyewitness documents. They contain all the ingredients of eyewitness material in terms of place names, name names, slight variation in minor details, not presenting the eyewitness in a good light. My lawyer friends, who I've read the Gospels with, even non-Christian ones, have said to me, actually, this reads like eyewitness material that you'd be prepared to accept. So I'd be very happy to spend a lot of time talking to my Muslim friends. But Jesus was crucified, and he was crucified on grounds of blasphemy. They couldn't escape that. He claimed, therefore, to be God, to be divine. And I want to begin to say, well, could we explore some of the evidence and say to ourselves, well, if he was, yeah.
How about the specific Muslim question often is that the Gospels are roughly speaking true but have been distorted, and in particular the idea that Jesus is God has been inserted in there. I don't know, Rob, how do you talk to people about that?
I think I just asked my Muslim friends to say, well, where have you got that from? Where's your evidence for it? If the Gospels have been changed in some way, you need to show me what they were like beforehand. So you've got to kind of before and after. That's what shows changes actually happened. And I think one of the big things for my Muslim friends, I'll go back to somewhere like Surah 5, verse 43 onwards, that talk about there is, present tense, there is guidance and light in the Torah, the Old Testament, and the Injil, the New Testament. And so for some Muslim friends, I've said, look, it says this, so how can you claim it's been changed in some way? And I can think of one guy who I'm still waiting for an answer from him on this. And I haven't had answers because it says there is guidance and light in the Old and New Testament. So for my Muslim friends, I'd ask them to read it.
Thank you. You go to the letters of the early church fathers, and all the claims that we've been talking about this evening within very, very short time frame, all there in their writings, and they're claiming to have got them from the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, as the only true Gospels in the record of Jesus. So the evidence is... Anyway, that's not an evening for this tonight.
Thank you. There are questions about dialogue with Muslims and how to do it well, and let's start with one of the dangers. What are the pitfalls of engaging in dialogue with Muslims? Mm.
Thank you. I mean, Rob, you've done far more than I have on this.
Many and various pitfalls. So as Christians, we can misunderstand what other Christians are doing. So I remember a couple of years ago, we had a meeting for better understanding with some Muslim people, and we were being accused of compromising, of becoming Muslims and that kind of thing. That clearly wasn't the agenda of the meeting, but there can be a misunderstanding that you're compromising your faith in some way. I think there can also be the pitfalls of it. People think it's a debate, a fight, a battle. And that just presents people not seeking want to listen to each other, to understand and to hear one another. And so what we've tried to do here in various places with Christians and in mosques is have these meetings for better understanding where we pick a topic and we discuss it from a Christian point of view and a Muslim point of view. There will be points of similarity, but there will also be points of contrast. But we seek to listen to one another and preach to one another as we build a relationship and build a friendship and seek to persuade with one another. That's at a kind of a corporate level. At an individual level, I've sought to read the Bible with Muslim people, some of whom are very happy to do so, and we'll start in Genesis, and others a bit more reticent. And so what we've done is, okay, we share some characters in common, let's look at them from the Quran and look at them from the Bible. So let's see what Adam and Eve are like in the Quran, let's look at what Adam and Eve are like in the Bible. Just compare and contrast, see where the big themes of our scriptures are going. And particularly picking up from John 8, one of the big themes of those early chapters of Genesis is sin and the seriousness of sin and how we're all steeped in sin in some way. And Muslim people need to understand that from stories about Adam and Eve, Cain and Abel, Noah and Abraham, and so on. Mm.
Is it worth just saying as well to bear in mind that for a Muslim person, so embedded in culture and identity and everything, that to realise just the magnitude of what we're discussing when we're talking about Jesus. And, you know, the personal danger to them, and that particularly with family so strong, I mean, you know, they show us up, don't they, in terms of relational strength, actually to begin to have a sense of just what we're doing when we're talking with our Jewish and Muslim friends. In terms of the kind of the stakes are very, very high for them. Doesn't mean we should not do it. We should go ahead, but we should be just conscious of what's at stake for some of these guys.
Thank you. Well, off the back of that, there's been a couple of questions. I think basically saying you have been too respectful to Muslim people tonight, citing maybe things that Muhammad has said or things that Muslims do in other countries to Christians. How do you respond to that?
Can you just give me the specific...
We'll say Muslims have no respect for Jesus at all. Christians are persecuted. How come you've been so nice, effectively, is
yes.
the point?
Yeah, I mean, because I'm wanting you to think about it. Not all Muslims... I think there's a tremendous easy for us to take the tabloid line and to say, because I read this in the tabloids, or because this happened in northern Nigeria, this happens everywhere. And I know lots of Muslim friends who actually would call themselves culturally Muslim, but are not wedded to some of the teachings that produce that hostility. And I don't want to kind of box everybody in the same box in that way. But the logic stands. If you hate the followers of Jesus and hate Jesus to such an extent that you won't accept his teaching, then you've got to ask which family you're from. But I've not wanted to take a very sort of tabloid approach. And I'm aware that I've tried to treat, you know, Muslim friends who are here this evening respectfully. We're all conscious of the sort of thing the Telegraph was writing about on Saturday and of the sort of thing, you know, we know is going on in Afghanistan where people are having to flee the country. If Jesus is a prophet and you are seeking to kill his followers, then Jesus' comment is self-evidently, you're of the devil. Have to be. Can't be on his side if that's what you're looking to do. Self-evidently so.
Thank you. Rob, do you want to add anything to that? Last question, I think, for time that we've got is on the content of some of what you said, William. So why is the Quran wrong about sin and forgiveness? So the question is, why can't God just forgive sin as Islam teaches? There was another one on how does Jesus give freedom in a way that Muhammad can't?
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, interestingly, if you go back and read the teaching of Moses is very clear
that God's justice will not allow him to forgive rebellion against him. And, you know, simple illustration. Let's take Matt here. Imagine he was to come in this evening with a big axe, and he would walk up to me and say, "William, I've had enough of you," and plunge the axe into my head. Okay, and that's me, mess all over the ground. Okay, tomorrow, Charlie, who happens to be the local judge, says to Matt as he comes into court, "Look, Matt, I know you made a filthy mess on the carpet, and you know, but you're basically a fairly reasonable bloke, and it was an aberration, and never mind, don't do it again." Or, you know, there has to be justice. And God's, and you read that, I mean, wherever you look, you see that. And God demands that he will not let the guilty go unpunished. That's what he tells us. And it's a wonderful thing. Imagine a God who just willy-nilly said, "Oh, well, I'll punish him, I won't punish her. I will punish her and I won't punish him. And actually, though they've done basically the same thing, I'm going to..." It just becomes arbitrary. It's so ugly. And I'll just actually ultimately sweep it under the carpet. Now, God's standard is 100% perfection. His justice is absolute. How can he then forgive? And the glorious truth, at the heart of the whole character of God, and from cover to cover of the Bible, is that he loves to forgive. And in his kindness and mercy and generosity, he so loved the world that he sent his only Son to carry in himself God's judgment at our sin, so that he could justly punish sin on the cross and justly forgive sin as we come under the shelter of Jesus and accept the forgiveness he offers. And that just is not available in Islam. It just is not available. You're left with Allah all merciful and willy won't he, and there's none of that. And actually, I think it's a real flaw. Problems with justice, problems with love, problems with the character of God, the integrity of God, all of that is at stake. And I don't think you find it in the Quran.
Thank you. Thank you both very much. That's all the time I think we have for questions.
Next
but
week.
Rob is around at the end. Please talk to Rob. Lots of experience. William will be here. Come back next week. Is that what we were saying? We'll be on materialism in particular, so we'll carry on. There'll be chances for more questions after that.